Welcome to Radio Gorgeous and author of the week. This week we have Bev Thomas, author of A Good Enough Mother. It is a literary psychological suspense thriller. And I was entranced. Can you, Bev Thomas, introduce us to the story of A Good Enough Mother?
Sure. I used to work as a clinical psychologist, so it's very much set in that world of therapy. And the main character is a therapist, a very experienced therapist called Ruth Hartland. And Ruth is brilliant at her job, director of the trauma unit. And but the only thing is her family life is in some turmoil, which she is keeping hidden from work. So it really starts out with her coming in to collect a new client, a new patient, and the person she collects looks rather shockingly like her missing 17-year-old son, Tom. And for a brief second, she thinks it's him. And really, things start to unravel for her after that. I mean, essentially, it's a story about grief, about maternal grief. She is a woman who is struggling with her loss and is in some ways unable to do, and in some ways she's unable to do what she's encouraging all of her clients to do, which is to talk about it and to accept it, and perhaps herself not be there, or certainly she knows she shouldn't be seeing this person. So I can't really say too much more about what rolls on after that, but it really is, it's a sort of opens a window to the secret world of therapist and patient, and the very intense dynamic in the room, and it's also an exploration of motherhood, the limitations and responsibilities of motherhood and the difficulties of that.
I think that perfectly sums it up. One thing I would say is that as an American, I think I'm, and as a New Yorker in particular, I am much more schooled in the ways of therapy and, you know, everything's a journey. Like, if you haven't been in therapy, you're like, what?
Yeah.
And if anyone's in therapy, you're like, oh, I'm so jealous. You get to spend 45 minutes every week just talking about yourself and your problems. But here, I definitely get the sense that it is trauma that is what people consider mental health and needing therapy. Mm-hmm. Whereas there is a disconnect in terms of what we see and experience in our own lives, in our daily lives. We all struggle with things. Mm-hmm. And we see our children struggle with things. And we say, and yet, oh, no, therapy wouldn't be for me. Mm. But one of the things I loved about your book is there was a seamless introduction to what the work of psychology is and how therapy works and how therapy works for the therapist and how therapy works, you know, for the patient, and why there is a phrase that is, we are steeped in, physician, heal thyself. So, and I don't want our listeners to get any idea that it's a, like Psych 101, but because it was seamless and really important. Thank you. And obviously fed by your by your experience. Is that whole idea, and we need that in the book, because she makes, as things are revealed, we don't realize how damaged she is at first.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's told from her perspective.
Yeah.
And so we see at the beginning, head of a trauma unit, very professional, hyper aware of her team and how they're doing and how she should be managing them in the context of the NHS and the trauma unit that she's managing. And then we see, we have to know those things in order to understand the ramifications of the seemingly small mistakes and transgressions that she makes. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? And because it is a big it's an exploration and a portrait of her in that situation and trauma and family and grief, as you were saying. But that is a big push of it. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I'm really glad you brought it up, because I suppose I was really interested in the therapy not being a sort of plot point or something that the characters do in order for something to happen. I wanted it to be absolutely at the heart of the story. So the plot rolls out from the characters, not the other way around. So we really have to understand the psychology behind these people, and in particular, obviously, Ruth, but also the other characters too. But I mean, I suppose, you know, the sort of leap from working as a therapist to a writer. I mean, part of therapy is listening to people tell their stories and make sense of their stories and their lives. So I found that I wanted that to be the heart of the book, really. And I suppose your point about the... I mean, it's lovely to hear that it's seamless, because that's great. It's an awful lot of work, isn't it, to make it seamless. But no, I was also very interested in... because my own background had been in that particular type of therapy, so more influenced by psychoanalytic psychotherapy, I was also interested in that being explored more rigorously. So, of course, there are stories where some of the transgressions between patient and therapist are huge, and they're kind of plot devices. My interest was finding a way of exploring this type of therapy and showing the reader, without telling them, but showing the reader that these are small but big and they grow. So there's a kind of domino effect from offering somebody more sessions than they would normally get, from not referring them on straight away. They're all very small, but of course they are a measure of her absolute need to keep seeing this person, which of course, as I said, is because of her grief and loss. If she wasn't grieving, she would be very clear and saying, well, this is a person that I can't see. So I was very interested in the kind of minute detail. I don't know if you saw in Treatment, there was a television with Gabriel Byrne, who played the therapist. That was some years ago. And I guess it probably wasn't for everyone, but if you like therapy and seeing what happens, they did a sort of episode per... so each episode was an hour of or 50 minutes of therapy, and then he saw his supervisor. But actually, you know, it's incredibly tense. And I suppose I wanted to try and find a way of writing about that, so that you are gripped not only by the drama that's going on in the room, but also by the theory, because I think it's fascinating. I mean, you know, obviously not everybody thinks it's fascinating, but trying to make it open up to an audience who might not know anything about it was my aim.
Well, and what's so interesting about it is that it is mirrored in motherhood as well. Yeah. And of course, everybody's interested in psychology. It's people, we work. And then the very idea of that is your work. So you're in a work situation which is encoded in rules and behaviors and whatever. And yet your work is about feelings. And having to manage that. And so there's a system in place to help you manage that. And there's different characters in what has brought them to be therapists and the desire to help and the desire to affect change, and whether you can or not, and whether this is, you know, whether that's a reasonable expectation. Yeah. But in also, because I remember from being in therapy situations, and in a trauma therapy situation in particular, like Dan, he is in a desperate situation mentally and emotionally.
Yeah.
And he's floundering around. Mm. And like a person drowning, they will take the person who's coming to save them down with them in their desperation. And the sort of manipulative nature of being a patient and trying to find your way to survive, that is also captured.
Yes.
And really interesting.
Mm.
And the idea that as a therapist, she is required to be in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me a little bit about that aspect and both of the novel and of the work.
Mm. So, yeah, it's interesting because I don't touch on her. She is a psychotherapist, and for which I'm not. I didn't train as a psychotherapist, but all psychotherapists have to go through a very rigorous period of therapy themselves. So they come to the work, particularly if they're working using the transference. They come to the work knowing themselves, or having a kind of real sense of self-awareness about who they are and what they bring into the room. So she is alert to that. And that doesn't mean, I mean, the people who do work in that way, they all have supervisors and then should be seeing their supervisors in order to discuss things that come up. So it's not that the more self-aware you have and the more good at your job, the less fallible you are to it. It's almost the opposite. You know, I think that a lot of people starting out thinking, oh, you just have supervision or you have a place to take your work if you're newly qualified. I mean, of course, that's not the case. That you need a sort of third person, as it were, in order to oversee some of that. So, but you're absolutely right. She brings her own stuff, not only into the room, but in terms of her past. And that was very significant for me to want to weave that in, that she has had her own difficult journey, which, while it's not sort of put in there, but one might perhaps draw some conclusions as to why she's gone into working in that field. And I think one of her, her student also talks a little bit about that as the book goes on. And we also see, again, without giving too much away, that there are many people who are I suppose there's a difference, isn't there, between private therapy and public sector NHS therapy, but people who are really overburdened. They go into work and they are fantastic and they are overburdened by a very stretched system. And there are also real consequences for that, because those are not enough resources. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of things I was trying to say without trying to say them as if I was standing on a soapbox, but there's quite a lot, I think, that I felt very passionate about in terms of psychological and mental health, and also about the brilliant work that people do. I mean, I think that's the other thing to say, is that I've been incredibly fortunate in my clinical career to work with some really exceptional people, and my sense is that there is amazing work that goes on, you know, and sometimes we just read about these awful events on the front of a newspaper and have no real sense of how people put their lives back together. And often there are people who are working behind the scenes helping people put their lives exactly back together after something really traumatic has happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it was also opening a bit of that, as well as the fact that, you know, she obviously, I mean, if I wrote a book about a perfect piece of therapy and everybody was happy, I probably wouldn't be sitting talking to you here. But I guess there is a sense of her, you know, while she has her issues, which means that there are consequences for her and other people, it is also that world that I think it is, that I also wanted to celebrate. People do amazing work.
And that also goes to what I was saying, that idea that you can be very self-aware when it comes to being a mother, and yet helpless to stop yourself from repeating patterns,
yeah.
Or you're almost powerless to try not to help in the way that you know how, or
yeah.
In the way of who you are and everything that you has brought you to this moment. It's absolutely similar. And there is a phrase, good enough parenting, and good enough mothering. It's an incredibly hard act.
Yes. And I think, I mean, the point you made about the parallel between the therapy and mothering or motherhood, I mean, I think that she is such an interesting character because it's very multi-layered, isn't it? So she is, in inverted commas, looking for a son because her son is missing. And the person who comes in is looking for a mother because of his issues. So it's a sort of perfect storm between the two of them.
Absolutely.
And that in a way is why it's so difficult for her to extrapolate from it. But I think you're right about the, you know, there are so many things that we sort of know that in terms of motherhood or parenting, but it's so difficult in the moment, isn't it, when there are feelings involved. And how, I mean, one of the things that Ruth is so aware of in terms of the work that she does with her clients is the importance of being in the room with people's feelings and enabling them to learn to accept them in order to move through. But somehow, because it's so painful with her own son, she has this huge blind spot and she is in denial about that. So in a way, her pain at being able to bear some of his difficulties means that she doesn't see him for who she is. She doesn't, she perhaps tries to get him to be somebody that he's not. So he seems to feel less and less seen as the book goes on. And of course, well, as the backstory is revealed. And I guess, you know, one of the things that, I mean, I deliberately made them him as one of a twin because I think that made it really interesting to be able to look at making those comparisons with that she does. She makes comparisons between her son Tom and her daughter Carolyn. But I think there is something that's just, she's just blind to being able to sort of really see what's going on. And I think in part that's because she's in a way trying so desperately to do something different to her own experience of being mothered. And in a way, by trying to do it so differently, she kind of has another blind spot.
Exactly. I mean, it occurs to me that as far away as we like to run from our own parenting models that we found negative, we find a way to repeat them in another way, you know, endlessly.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Yeah, and interestingly for somebody like her who one can assume, although it's not gone into in any great detail, she has a supervisor, she's gone through an endless journey of her own therapy. But I guess that's what I was quite interested in, is that I think grief and loss it's something that is so all-consuming. And I suppose from looking back to my work as a clinician, it is something that, I mean, not just bereavement, but loss in lots of different forms, loss of identity, loss of job, or loss of a person through drug, mental health, alcohol problems. Loss is such a it's such a frequent thing that comes into the consulting room or comes into the work, you know, into work.
So it's a profound
absolutely
issue in our lives. It's the first one, separation, yep. Abandonment. Those are our first wounds. Those are our first fears.
Absolutely. And I think that, so I was always very interested in exploring that anyway, and had explored it in sort of previous writing that I've done. But somehow once I'd kind of sort of located it in this world, it sort of it kind of rolled out in some mm-hmm. ways, because of course she's aware and not aware.
Yes. And as you say, it was a perfect storm. I mean, she had a sort of massive gaping Tom-shaped hole.
Absolutely.
And in walked someone who she could put right into it, rightly or wrongly.
Yeah.
But it is also a book about redemption. And I was really interested. We all make mistakes, and she does make a sort of snowballing series of minor yet huge, in terms of their long-reaching impact, mistakes. And how it seems to me, we live in a society where our mistakes are more overblown than ever with social media. Everyone knows our mistakes. And yet taking responsibility and incorporating those mistakes, acknowledging them and moving on doesn't seem to be anywhere. You know, sort of in the social media world. And, you know, okay, so how does accepting mistakes. How do we?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose I also imagine that this book is focused very much on people who have been through an experience of some kind of trauma. So they're in a particularly desperate state. But I think lots of people also would go to seek help because they want to understand themselves a bit differently or to look back on things that may or may not have happened, how they may have... I think the issue often is it's rather than this has happened with a sense of blame or fury about it, this has happened and what might my role have been in that process? And I think that... that's a very difficult concept sometimes because I think that it's easier to locate something over there with somebody else or somebody else was responsible for not doing X or not doing Y, you know, in the workplace, etc., whatever. And I think it's a real journey, isn't it, to be able to understand, okay, well, so that happened, that was terrible, what might my part have been in that? Or... if something goes wrong at work, how could we understand this differently? And I think that, increasingly, I'd like to think that more and more public sector are moving to a place where they're able to think reflectively about things that haven't gone well, to understand, to be able to use the experience rather than thinking, well, that went wrong because of that individual. And actually, very often, there are some systemic failures that have led to something that hasn't worked out, and it's too easy to locate it on one or two individuals, whereas actually there's a systemic breakdown of something. I mean, I think in this book there is a series of things that have come together, so if you take a few things out of the sort of Jenga pile, as it were, the ultimate the end wouldn't necessarily have happened that way. So I kind of think life is like that. It is much more complicated. So I guess my exploration in this book is to look at psychological and mental health. It's also to look at motherhood and parenting. There aren't really any easy answers to either of those things. And it was never my intention to sort of write a book that had answers. I guess there's a lot of complexity and sort of onion layers, as it were, in the process. And I guess I really wanted people to think about things, really. Yeah.
And in your own life, is it difficult to put aside the sort of psychiatry head? And is that, I was thinking that might be one of the things that fed your writing, so that you could put it there and not have to look at your family,
your own stuff,
yourself,
yeah.
Everyone around you.
Well, it's interesting because I am, I did work for, I trained as a clinical psychologist and worked for quite a few years as a psychologist. And then I then moved into working, which I do now, as an organisational consultant in mental health and other services. So a lot in the public sector, mainly with individuals and teams who are working, as it were, in the front line. And it's really interesting because I have been writing for a long time, and I sort of deliberately, or I didn't really think about it, but I was very reluctant to write about my world of work. So I was exploring the themes that I was interested in, but in other centuries. I mean, I had a sort of, I did a bit of historical fiction, which didn't really work out, which didn't really suit me. Lots of sort of journeys, I suppose, in my writing experience over the years, all of which I enjoyed, but somehow, and then once I'd sort of thought, well, actually, because I was very conscious, because I'm still working, I didn't want the focus of the book to be on a client or on... So it was only when I sort of flipped it and thought, oh, well, I could write about a therapist who is brilliant, but she's got an Achilles heel, and it sort of released things from there. So, and I guess it was a sort of book that, having worked for so long with some of these concepts, it was such a lovely opportunity to be able to explore them in a fictional way, because ultimately people read books, fictional books, because they want to have a story told to them, they want to be entertained, but also some of the reviews seem to be coming back and saying, I've learned something about something that I didn't know about, I've never had therapy, I didn't know about this concept, it's been really helpful, which of course, you know, as a psychologist and a writer is fantastic to hear.
So it's also good to hear that as a thinking person, as a therapist, that you thought you could get away from the old adage, write what you know, and you tried it, and you failed, yeah. And then you wrote what you knew.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, it obviously works for some people, doesn't it? But it,
well, it ultimately worked for you.
Yeah,
as
no,
well.
It did work for me, and it, no, completely. And I did an event recently, and they were saying, well, what would be your two pieces of advice, you know, for writers who want to write? And I said, well, for me, it was definitely write what you know. And persevere, because you know, I don't think I'm sure there are some people who are, they write a book, it happens really quickly. That wasn't my journey, but I think, you know, often I will pick up a book that I love, being able to enter a world that I don't know anything about. So I think it is, whatever, whether it's a contemporary or in the past, it is fantastic if somebody does that well. So I'm not quite sure why I was so maybe the idea hadn't come to me, but yeah, it didn't. It definitely did. It definitely worked for me in the end.
Had to go around for your journey
around the houses,
anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
It's good to know that, you know, there's no escaping.
Yeah,
there's no escaping, yes, who we are. But you know, as long as we get there eventually.
Yeah, exactly. You know, exactly.
Well, I have to say that it is all of those things, and as Paula Hawkins, author of The Girl on the Train, has said, it is a taut, absorbing, and psychologically astute. So I would encourage everyone to go out and get A Good Enough Mother by Bev Thomas. Bev, thank you so much for being on Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. It's been lovely to be here. Thank you so much.
And for more fascinating women, please go to www.radiogorgeous.com.